I encourage you to open your Bibles this evening to Matthew chapter 26. That's where we will begin this evening as we continue in our series that we have been looking at that is based on the final 24 hours in the life of Jesus Christ. Certainly glad that we're able to be here. This has, for me, been a very helpful, at times a very eye-opening series to study. Just because of taking the time to really look at some of the final moments in the life of our Lord and Savior as He was on this earth prior to His crucifixion. And there was a lot, as we've already seen, that has just happened in this last day. We are almost to the trial of Jesus. Not quite. We've worked our way through Thursday afternoon and Thursday evening and Thursday night and find ourselves again this evening. Somewhere late at night, wee hours of the morning, something in that range. If you're visiting with us, we're certainly thankful you're here. All of these lessons, or nearly all of them, I think we actually missed one by way of recording, but most all of them are available either on a CD form, which you're more than happy to have at no charge if you're interested in listening to those. Just fill out a request form in the foyer. And then also they're available online. Be happy to give you that web address afterwards if you would like to download any of those online. You probably remember the headline that was followed by several similar headlines not too awful long back. This is one of them. It says, two planes land without clearance at Reagan National as only controller on duty reportedly falls asleep. Do you remember those? And then that happened again. And it happened again. I remember it happening again, and it happened a fifth time at least, I know, because I read one of the articles where they talked about the fifth incident in a row that had transpired like that. This article went on to say, federal aviation officials are reviewing air traffic controller staffing at airports around the country after two airliners landed at Reagan National Airport without clearance from the airport tower because they were unable to raise anyone there. Goes on to say that they were in contact with a regional tower, a regional facility that gave them directions, at least let them know what was in the air. The problem with that is the regional direction would not know exactly everything that's going on the ground, and so it still created a little bit of a scary situation for them. It said the planes, and matter of fact, the regional called, this article was interesting, because the regional called the local tower at Reagan for quite some time, never receiving an answer, tried multiple calls, never got an answer there. It says the planes involved were American Airlines Flight 1012, a Boeing 737 with 91 passengers, six crew members on board, and a United Airlines Flight 628T, an Airbus 320 with 63 passengers and five crew members on board. I just want you to keep that logged into mind. We're going to leave that story now, and I know you're going to wonder for a while what it has to do with anything that we're talking about, but we'll come back to that. That's a headline I know that was familiar to us, and a headline that I know was bothersome. The stories were bothersome to us as well. But I want you to pick up with me, if you would, in Matthew chapter 26, as we are continuing to look at these last hours on earth of Jesus and the things that were going on, and that we can see a couple of things in this. That we find Jesus at this time, as we said, somewhere between midnight and daybreak is where we're going to pick this up. And you remember, Jesus has been praying with his disciples and been praying separate from his disciples. First in John chapter 17, a prayer that was with them and in their presence and talking about what he prayed on their behalf and on his own behalf and on all of our behalf. And then he prayed separately from them, telling them to pray. But he went off about a stone's throw, it says, and he got down on the ground, fell on the ground, and he started praying as well. When we pick up the story, that's where we're picking it up. He has been praying. He's gone back, you remember, those repeated times to the disciples and saying, why are you sleeping? Can't you just stay awake for an hour? And can't you just watch? Can't you just pray? And he goes off to pray again, and he comes back and they're asleep again, and he tells them the same thing again, and he goes off to pray again, and he comes back a third time, and he says that they're sleeping again. He knew they were weary. It says he knew they were weary. And yet he was still asking them to stay awake and pray, but they, in fact, did not do so. And then we pick up the text, and it's going to say in verse 46, or verse 45. Then he came to his disciples and he said, "Are you still sleeping and resting? Behold, the hour is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into the hands of sinners. Rise, let us be going. See, my betrayer is at hand." Now, just picture what's going on in the mind of Jesus. Three times in a row he's been praying, "Let this cup pass from me, let this cup pass from me, but your will, not my will. Let this cup pass, but your will, not my will, be done." And then going back to the disciples and finding them sleeping again, says, "Guys, get up. The time's here. We've reached the time that I've been telling you about." All those conversations that he'd had previously, he says, we're there, guys. You need to get up. "Behold, the one who betrays me is at hand." Jesus, you get the picture that Jesus could see or hear Judas coming. He could have certainly known anyway, but I think he's right there in their midst. And this tells us that this, while he was yet speaking, we're told, this time frame, probably 3, 4 a.m., something like that, while he was yet speaking, "Behold, Judas, one of the 12, with a great multitude with swords and clubs, came from the chief priests and elders of the people. Now his betrayer had given them a sign, saying, 'Whomever I kiss, he's the one, seize him.' Immediately he went up to Jesus and said, 'Greetings, Rabbi,' and kissed him. And Jesus said to him, 'Friend, why have you come?' And then they came and laid hands on Jesus and took him. And suddenly one of those who were with Jesus stretched out his hand, drew his sword, struck the servant of the high priest, and cut off his ear. But Jesus said to him, 'Put your sword in its place, for all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Or do you think that I cannot pray now to my Father, and he will provide me with more than 12 legions of angels? How then could the scripture be fulfilled that it must happen thus?' In that hour, Jesus said to the multitudes, 'Have you come out as against a robber with swords and clubs to take me? I sat daily with you, teaching in the temple, and you did not seize me. But all this was done that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled.' And then all the disciples forsook him and fled." A couple of great lessons, I think, in here. Some things that we want to make sure we pick up on. One of them I would tell you that we're really not dealing with tonight, but this account, and I don't mean just Matthew's account, I mean this section in the life of Christ, is as great a testimony as why you need to couple all the Bible together as opposed to pulling something out all by itself. It's a great example of that, because there is information that is in Matthew that's not in Mark, Luke, or John. There's information that's in Mark that's not in Luke or John or Matthew, and same way with Luke. There are things that Luke says that aren't in the other accounts. There's things that John say that aren't in the other accounts. But reading them all together and looking at all of them, you get a real good picture of what happened in this arrest scene. You get an idea of this absolute whirlpool of emotion and action that is going on. It's just, there's such unbelievable contrast in the values that are displayed and the emotions that are felt and displayed. There's loyalty and there's betrayal in this scene. There's courage by some, there's cowardice by others. There's great power demonstrated here, as well as great weakness. There's calmness and the ability to act calmly under duress or pressure, and there's great impulsiveness as well. There is wounding and healing that is demonstrated all in this one passage. You see all of those things being contrasted one with another. In Luke chapter 22 and verse 46, it says, "Get up and pray," is what he had told them on the one occasion to the disciples. He says, "Get up and pray so that you will not enter into temptation." Luke 22, 46. So he's telling them, look, it isn't just a matter of what I'm asking you to do. It wasn't asking for on his behalf. He was saying, guys, it is about to absolutely get as bad as it's ever been or ever will be in your life. You remember Jesus telling Peter, Satan has asked to sift you like wheat? He's going to have Peter in the shaker real shortly here. And Peter's going to have to make some decisions and doesn't make all good decisions here. Why? I think because he hadn't prayed. He hadn't spent the time on his knees before the throne of God that Jesus did. And Jesus says, get up and pray so that you don't enter into temptation. But the problem is now, time for prayer is done. Time for prayer is over for Peter. I don't mean that they won't ever pray again, but I'm saying regarding this situation, the time for prayer is over. The betrayer is there. Jesus said, it's upon us. It's not gonna help now to think that now we can drop and pray for the strength. And there's a great lesson in that for us, I think. Sometimes we wait until it's right there in our face before we seek the help. And God is saying, prepare for it, prepare for it, prepare for it so you can be ready when it comes. It's tough. It's tough in the face of that opposition to find the strength that you're looking for. And so while he was yet speaking, the betrayer comes upon him. I want us to look at a couple of different things. One, who was there? And then secondly, some of the emotions, some of the reactions, some of the attitudes that were displayed here. Interesting the way the accounts describe this. Matthew says it was a large crowd armed with swords and clubs. That's the way Matthew describes it. He says, Judas, one of the 12, and a great multitude with swords and clubs was who came. These people coming to Jesus, Jesus is later going to ask a question about that and say, look, I sat in the temple every day. I taught. I was right there. He says, and now you're going to come out like I'm some kind of insurrectionist, like I've raised some kind of movement, like I've ever had the intent of fighting for where I am. They came out with swords and clubs. And Matthew just says it was this large multitude, this great crowd, and they had come at the behest of the chief priest and those others that were a part of the Jewish hierarchy. Mark adds that they were teachers of the law that came. In Mark chapter 14, verse 43, he says that they were teachers of the law, the scribes. It wasn't just at the request of those who were in the religious position. We're going to find that there are both Jews and Gentiles in this crowd that has come out. But Mark says these are teachers of the law. I think that's important because Jesus is going to ask a question of them in a moment that sometimes we just look at and don't take the time to ask, why did he even ask that question? But he is. He's going to ask a question. But Mark adds that to the picture. Says that they are they're teachers of the law. But Luke goes on to say they are chief priests, they are officers of the temple guard, and the elders. That's the way Luke describes it in chapter 22, verse 52. These are captains of the temple. The term he uses for officers of the temple guard. There were guards that's what they did. They guarded the temple to do the best they could to keep those that were unclean or unholy from going into the holy place. And that was their job. And they appear to have been either a contingent of them that weren't on duty or even those maybe had left the temple who should have been guarding it that night. That was normally when they guarded it. And so they've probably left the temple. They've come to come get Jesus, the Holy One, out of the garden. He says they were the elders. He uses the same word there that we use for elder all throughout the New Testament. Presbyteros is the word there in the Greek. And he says of them that they were there. This is a group of the ruling council of the Sanhedrin. These were the most important of the Jews. This wasn't just a Roman army that was sent out. The Jews were there. And the most influential Jews were there, Luke says. They were all there. John goes on to say that there was a detachment of men in John chapter 18. Some versions say a band of men. He uses a word that to us doesn't necessarily carry any particulars, but it did to them. And look at John chapter 18. John chapter 18, starting in verse 1. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples over the brook Kidron, where there was a garden, which he and his disciples entered. And Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. Then Judas, having received a detachment of troops, that doesn't necessarily tell us much, does it? Except it really does. He's leading them, we're told. He's the one that's out front of them, being led by Judas. In other words, preceding them, Luke tells us. He was the one that was out in front of the group. Not that he was in charge, But he was the one they were following. So, you think about the nature of Judas being at the head of all of this, and he's got behind him these chief priests, these scribes, these elders, the ones who are from the temple guard, and then it says also this cohort of officers, or this detachment of men, this band of men. None of those words gives us a picture of how many were there. But it did them. There would probably be better words to help us understand that, or more description of that. A cohort, or a band, or a detachment, whichever word is used, was composed of 6 centuries of men, or 1/10 of a legion of men. A legion was 6,000 soldiers. So that means that we're dealing with in the neighborhood of 600 soldiers. I just want you to picture that for a minute. They're coming to get one man. One man who had never been armed in his life, who had never sought to create some kind of insurrection against the government, had never tried to fight with anybody, and they sent out 600 soldiers along with the Jewish leaders that were there. Remember the picture we showed of Gethsemane at night? You can almost get a picture of that, can't you? The idea, maybe they thought they were just going to have to search everywhere. Maybe Jesus and his disciples were going to be fleeing or hiding, and they needed to kind of scour the entire garden. They needed the whole hillside there. 600 men. You ever wonder why it was that the disciples were as afraid as they were? I mean, just imagine that there's 12 of you, Jesus and the 11. And there's 600 soldiers and all the religious leaders coming out with clubs and with swords. How well armed are you? You remember when Jesus talked to them about swords and they said, we have 2, and he said, it's enough. That they apparently have 2 swords. Between the 12 of them, they have 2 swords. And the word that is used there when Peter draws his sword in a moment is the short sword, the dagger-like sword. So these aren't the big fighting swords. These are the kind of hand-to-hand combat, up-close kinds of swords, more like a dagger. They had 2 of those. They had this cohort, 600 men that are coming towards them, this detachment, the ones who are going to coming to arrest Jesus in the garden. And so what you find is there's some very different reactions that go on. And I think that's what we learn from in this situation. I think we learn from the calm of Jesus. John 18 again. Remember we talked about the incredible agony that Jesus was in when he was in the garden? And in John 18, verse 3 says, Judas, having received a detachment of troops and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees, came there with lanterns, torches, and weapons. Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that would come upon him, went forward and said to them, who are you looking for? The statement itself almost seems contradictory, doesn't it? Jesus, knowing all things that were about to come upon him, said, who are you looking for? He's calmly walking into this. I think there's more to his question than who are you looking for. I think you've got the Messiah, the Lord of all, who seems even to be providing one more opportunity for somebody to confess him, to acknowledge him. Who are you looking for? They were looking for Jesus the Nazarene, Jesus of Nazareth, they're going to say. That's what they were looking for. They weren't looking for Jesus, the Lord of all earth. They weren't looking for the Jesus that would take over their life. They were looking for a Jesus that they came to take, to manipulate, to arrest, and to take back to his trial. But I think Jesus is saying, who is it? Who is it that you're looking for? And so he tells Judas in Matthew chapter 26, he says, friend, do what you've come to do. I mean, there's this incredible calmness of Jesus. From the unbelievable agony that was in the garden to Jesus now saying, look, do what you got to do. Who'd you come for? What's this all about? let's just get this over with in that sense. In John chapter 18 and verse 5, look what Jesus said. When he says, "Whom are you seeking?" They answered him, "Jesus of Nazareth." And Jesus said to them, "I am he," is what the New King James says. Don't know what your version says. If you've got a New King James, I would guess the "he" is italicized, because that's exactly what he says there. Jesus says, "I am." This was not an identification of himself as Jesus of Nazareth. This was an identification of himself by the very words of God, the same words that Moses was told to speak when he said, when Pharaoh wants to know who in the world has sent me, when the Israelites want to know who it is that sent me, what am I going to tell him? God said, "You tell him I am. Sent you." Oh, this was the Son of God. And they said, "We're looking for Jesus of Nazareth." And he said, "I am." How do you know that they even grasped that? I mean, later he's going to continue to talk calmly, and they're going to take control of the situation, it appears. But right now, look what happens. Jesus said, "I am." And Judas, who betrayed him, also stood with him. And when he said to them, "I am," they drew back and fell on the ground. And so you've got not only the calm of Jesus, you've got the fear of the crowd. This is a scene. Can you picture this scene? 600 men plus the priests, plus the elders, plus the temple guard. All these people are there. And they said, "We're looking for Jesus of Nazareth." He walked out and voluntarily asked them. And Jesus stands there and says, "I am." And they hit the dirt. Isn't that an incredible picture? They fell back. Why? Because that is the result of recognizing you've come into the presence of God. That's not only a choice. You remember in Philippians chapter 2? I think this is a preview of the end of the time, the end of the age. Philippians chapter 2, Paul, as he's writing to those brethren, said, "Every knee shall bow, every tongue shall confess." He says, everyone that's on earth, everyone that's above the earth, everyone that's below the earth, every knee shall bow, every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. Do you ever try and picture that scene in your mind? I mean, is that a voluntary thing? Or do you think that there's no way, and come the judgment scene, do you think there's a way, come judgment, to go into the presence of God Almighty Himself and not acknowledge Him? I think even if you're a non-believer before that, you'll be like the demons that when Jesus approached them, they were screaming, "Go away, we know who you are." That they recognized. I think that's the impact it had. This crowd feared Jesus because of the statement that He made. "Every knee shall bow, every tongue shall confess." But it wasn't that. You got the deceit of Judas. It says that he had a sign that was previously worked out. He had already talked to them and said, "You know, this is the way we're going to do it. I'm going to go, and the guy that I kiss is going to be the one that you want." Jesus had already identified himself. But he says, "The one I kiss, that's the one that you're going to want." This is Judas that walked with him and talked with him, that broke bread with Jesus, the one who had this incredible deceit to go and to give Jesus a kiss as if he was greeting him like a friend. You know, when the disciples were told, "Greet one another with a holy kiss," that's what Judas was attempting to do as he was betraying him. And so what did Jesus do? Still calmly. But in Luke chapter 22, verse 48, Jesus says, "Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? Is that what you would do?" What an incredible rebuke of duplicity in the life of Judas. He's saying, "Really, Judas? You're going to play both games?" You know, when God says to the church of Laodicea, He said, "I would that thou wert cold or hot," but when you think you can straddle this middle, that's extremely problematic. I think He would tell us the same thing. I think He told Judas the same thing. Really? At the same time you're going to betray me, you're going to kiss me like we're friends. You know, and I think in terms of myself, and think, there have been times where I've done something or said something that God's response would be, really? You're going to claim to be who you are and claim that you love me the way that you say that you love me, and yet you still said that or you still did that? Duplicity is never acceptable to God. He says, you can't do that. You can't live both ways. We talked about that in our class this last Sunday, and the hypocrisy of Peter. That was the problem with hypocrisy. It's that you're trying to live both sides of it. He says, you can't do that. You've got the deceit of Judas there. You've got the violence of Peter. I mean, it says here of Peter, and this is one of the passages that you really need each of the Gospels to find out what happened, because one just says that one of his disciples cut off the ear of the high priest's servant. One says that the high priest's servant's name was Malchus. One says that the swordsman's name was Peter, and you get all that information. But what you find out is that the disciples are awake now. There's no question about that. They're awake now, but they're not thinking real clearly. They're going to call out to Jesus and ask, should we defend you? But before ever getting an answer, he pulls his sword and he cuts off the ear of a man. You can say what you want to say about Peter. That he was dull spiritually sometimes, he was. That he was impetuous, he was. No question about that. He was impulsive, he was. That he was the kind of person that thought more of himself than he should have thought. He was. Thought he had a strength that he didn't have. All of those things you could say about Peter, no question. That he made terrible decisions at times, he did. But in the garden this night, the one thing you cannot say about Peter is that he's a coward. You cannot say this man's a coward. There were cowards there, and he'll turn to cowardice, but he doesn't start there. I just want you to think, what does it take to draw your sword and cut off a man's ear when you've got two swords between you and you've got 600 soldiers that you're about to start a battle with? Cowardice doesn't do that. Peter was exactly where he said he would be. It wasn't, and if the Lord had said, keep fighting, I'm confident Peter would have fought until they stabbed him and killed him. No question. Peter reached out and he took that dagger, and as foolish as it was, he wasn't afraid to stand up and defend his Lord. But in John's Gospel, in chapter 18, in verse 11, it says, put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father has given me? We're not here to fight, Peter. I would tell you, the cowardice didn't come until Peter was told, we're not fighting. Now he didn't know what to do. He misunderstood the kingdom. He misunderstood the teachings of Jesus, but he was brave to that point. Matthew adds that all who live by the sword are going to die by the sword. That's not our method. That's not our kingdom. That's not what we're teaching here. Did you ever, when you read that article about the air traffic controllers, what bothered you the most? I mean, fortunately, I'm anticipating that none of us were on either of those two planes. I've never talked to anybody that was on either one of those two planes. Can't imagine I would have felt real good if I'd been on one of those planes. You know, I can still remember years and years ago somebody talking to me about flying, and I don't mind flying for the most part. Don't really enjoy it when the plane's going every which way but straight, but don't really mind flying so much. And then somebody said, you realize, I mean, they started talking about the tonnage of aircraft that you've got. And all this amount of metal that's in the sky. And what is it that's keeping it up? You know, as they talked about the engineering of lift and the concept of lift. And they said, you realize a landing is nothing but a controlled crash. I thought, well, I've heard more encouraging words than that. Every time I come, I think about that every time. And if that now causes you to think about that, I apologize for that. But every time we come into the runway, I think, here we come, controlled crash. We're crashing, but we got the wheels down. That's a good start. What if it's not even controlled? Isn't that what bothers you about that article? I mean, it's controlled as much as the pilot can do, but some things are outside of his control. Who's in control of the situation as that plane is coming in and they're calling to that tower and asking for information? That's the part that bothers me. You know what? At least if it's controlled, I feel okay. Peter didn't realize this was a controlled situation. And Jesus went on to say, Peter, really, what do you think? If that was the issue, fighting, if getting out of this was the issue, you don't think that I could call on my Father right now and He would send down 12,000 troops from heaven? Now who's got the numbers on their side? Jesus said he'll send down legions. Legions of men to fight for me. Do you not think that he will send down, he says, he'll send down 12 legions, maybe 70,000 people. Can you imagine that army that now assembles in the garden? 72,000 soldiers for God and 600 soldiers from the Roman army? I'm not thinking it's much of a contest. But he says, I could send down all those legions, 12 legions, if that's what I wanted to do. But Jesus is in charge. He's walking into this. He's allowing this to happen of his own volition. And he wants Peter to understand that. You see not only the violence of Peter, you see the love of Jesus. This, to me, is one of the greatest scenes of all. Peter reaches out and strikes off the ear of this high priest servant, Malchus. And Jesus immediately reaches out, and the word that he uses to say that he touched him is close contact. It's not like reaching out and touching with your finger. I get the picture that what Jesus did is he put his hands on his head. He took him and he held him, or put one hand on the one head, however he held him, and he healed the man's ear. What did Malchus feel like? He went from excruciating pain and having his ear removed to absolute comfort and wholeness. What did he feel like? This is the love of Jesus. This is Jesus saying, I told you to love your enemies. This man is the servant of my enemy, the one who is coming to kill me. He's carrying out his duty because that's what he has to do as the servant of the enemy. But I'm going to reach out and I'm going to heal him because I love him the same as I love everybody else. He says, and that's what my kingdom is about. I wonder about Malchus. Was his life ever the same again? Could you ever go through life a single day and not think about what had happened? There are some commentators that believe the reason his name is mentioned is because he later became a disciple, and it's a name that would have been recognized by those who were reading. Don't know that that's the case. But whether he ever became a disciple or not, I assure you he never forgot the loving touch of Jesus. He had no ear, and then he did. Jesus healed him. Incredible love displayed by Jesus. And finally, you get the fear of the 11. Because it says they seized Jesus. They arrested him. The word they use for seize is to just what you would think it is. It's to grab, it's to latch hold on, it's to secure tightly. Much the same as we might picture on TV when they throw somebody on the ground and they put handcuffs on them and they bring them up so that they're no longer under their own control, at least it would seem. That's what they did to Jesus. And now the disciples see that. They see him seize him, they grasp him. They see him taking him away. Now what are they going to do? They are scared to death. And they turn and they run. It says they all forsook. Peter, who drew his sword and was ready to fight to the death just moments before, turns and runs with the rest. Jesus wanted them, and I think wants us to understand some things as well. You ever think of the incredible irony that's in this whole situation? They come with swords and clubs to arrest the one who holds all power and all authority. It's no different than when Jesus told Pilate, none of this would be happening if my Father wasn't allowing it to happen. God's in control of all of this. Think about the irony of coming with lanterns at night in the darkness to arrest the light of the world. He said, I've always been there with you, but you come under the cover of darkness. That's why he tells them at one point, he says, it's your time. It's the time for evil to take charge. As they did that under the cover of darkness. That they came seeking the wrong Lord. They came seeking Jesus of Nazareth. What he was hoping they would seek was Jesus, the Lord and Master of all. The question is, where am I in all of that? What attitude do I display? Am I one of the ones that's afraid because of the world and the things that are on me? Am I deceitful? Am I the betrayer? Do I have the attitude of Peter and all the impulse and that impetuousness, but not the strength to continue on? Or do I have the love and the calmness of Jesus? That's an incredible scene in the life of Christ. Now, all of this just to get to the arrest. They haven't really spoken any words yet. They're going to take him on the trial, and the trial itself is extremely, extremely interesting and has some great lessons. But he says, just look at the arrest. And at least what I try to take away from that is a situation that appears that it was outside the control of Jesus was always in his control. Never for a moment did he not control the whole situation. So much so that he dictated the terms even of his arrest. He said, let them go so that it can be fulfilled, he said, that I didn't lose any of them. Let them go. You came for me, take me. I think they would have arrested the others. They grabbed one man that's in Mark's account that's not in the other accounts. One man came out apparently. Maybe he woke up during the night because of all the noise that was going on or something, because it says he came out and all he had on him was like a bed sheet, just like a covering of some type. And he wasn't wearing it where it drapes over your head. It was wrapped around him apparently like you would a sheet or a toga or something of that sort. Because they tried to grab him, maybe thinking he was one of the disciples, tried to grab him, and he just let go of the bed sheet and it says he just ran away naked. They came to take the whole group in, I think. Not just Jesus, but Jesus said, you're not taking them. Let them go. Never for a moment was he not in control. Never for a moment is he not in control today. If you're not a Christian, I think God would have you to understand, no promise of ease, no promise of all the niceties of life, but what he will promise you is this, that he will always be in control and he'll never forsake us. If that's the God you want to serve, that's the God that wants you to come serve him. If we can help you do that, let us know tonight while we stand and sing.